Hello, this is Aaron, and welcome back to the podcast. Thanks for listening. For those of you who were just listeners but have not actually gotten on the newsletter yet, please go to themasculinist.com and sign up. It's important to be on that list because if you just follow on podcast or on YouTube or something like that, I actually don't know who you are. And if something were ever to happen where I got kicked off one of these platforms, for example, I would never be able to come tell you where you could find me. But if I have your email address, I'll always be able to find you. So please get on the list if you're not already there. Appreciate it. I hope you guys enjoyed the audio version of The Masculinist I put in yesterday. You know, I realized that the audio quality wasn't actually that good on that recording. There was actually some microphone noise. Maybe there's some interference from some nearby electronics. I'm not sure. And I listened to it. I'm like, you know what? I'm not actually going to go back and re-record that. It sounds good enough. But hopefully today is going to be better. If this one doesn't turn out as well for some reason, I will actually go back and re-record it because I do want the audio quality to be great. Also, you may notice I didn't have the intro music today. You know, I got a complaint from someone, and I think it's a valid complaint. Hey, you know, the intro music's too long. And so, you know, I'm trying to experiment. Can we just do it without intro music? You almost don't sound like a real podcast, I think, almost sometimes if you don't have intro music. But feel free to send me feedback on what you think about whether we should keep it, ditch it, any suggestions that you have about that or anything else. And if you haven't already, please do leave a rating on Apple Podcasts because that really helps out with discoverability. I'm going to continue with my series on conservatism today. And you know, when I did my history of conservatism, I pointed out that although they like to talk about timeless principles or universal principles, the reality is that conservatism has really changed its mind on a lot of things, including a lot of very fundamental things, for example. So I noted, for example, that they changed their mind about civil rights. The original conservative movement that emerged after the war had opposed the Civil Rights Act. They were very opposed to civil rights. And then essentially after 64, after the Goldwater defeat, they essentially made their peace with civil rights. And they would even tell you today, yeah, we got that one wrong. Another thing that they've basically admitted they got wrong was gay marriage. Essentially conservatism today is very supportive of gay marriage. You know, the average kind of conservative pundit, even probably elected official, is a lot more socially liberal than they let on publicly. We're talking about people who live largely in New York City and Washington. They're very culturally blue people. And, you know, yes, there are a few very socially conservative people like Ryan Anderson, formerly of Heritage, who just now got hired as the president of EPPC. So congratulations to him. Or the First Things crew. You know, they're known as sort of very specifically religious conservative people. And, you know, they continue to oppose gay marriage. But that is very rare. Most of movement conservatism is very pro-gay marriage today. In fact, you know, and it's been that way for a while. I got some reports from the RNC's people back in the day who were supposedly, working on the anti-gay marriage side as all this was going down. And let's just say they were not exactly enthusiastic about stopping it. And just to give you a sense of where they are, Arthur Brooks, who is a religious Catholic convert, who was the president of the American Enterprise Institute, when one of his senior fellows came out as transgendered, Giselle Donnelly, he basically was very, very public supportive of that. So the Washington Post, I think it was, I wrote down the quote, but I forgot to say where it was from, said, quote, AEI President Arthur Brooks and Vice President for Foreign Policy Danielle Pletka told me that their decision to support Giselle was a simple one, since she's the same person dedicated to the same principles that made her a good fit for the institution all this time. We are proud that she is part of the AEI family, they told me. So that was them. By the way, this Giselle Donnelly is also very involved in BDSM, as it comes down in this article. And so, you know, they're very kind of pro-trans rights. Their National Review has already run pieces about the conservative case for trans rights. Rod Reher has noted he couldn't get anyone in the GOP even interested in religious liberty. It's just not something that they're interested in. So I think it's fair to say they have also changed their mind about the nature of gender and the family. And, you know, by the way, I would say most of them probably support keeping abortion legal, and most of them are probably very pro-gun control at some level as well. Making abortion illegal and keeping guns widely available are high on the list of your average Beltway movement conservative type. So essentially, right, if you admit you were wrong about civil rights, and you admit you were wrong about the nature of gender and marriage, is there anything you could possibly be right about? I mean, why would anyone follow people like this who admit that they got the most fundamental things in society wrong? All right, I mean, they flat out admit it, that they were wrong. And you know what? They're actually wrong about other things that they have not yet admitted that they are wrong about. And, you know, for people who are conservative and believe in its teachings, or at least its current teachings, again, they've radically shifted over time. So I don't think there's anybody today who still believes what conservatives believed, you know, 50 years ago. But, you know, the kind of conservatism has been around the last 20, 30 years. If you've really been one of those people, it can really be hard to believe that some of this stuff just actually isn't right. It just isn't accurate. But you have to be willing to open your mind on that. And again, think about all these other, even massively more fundamental things that they've already admitted they were wrong about. So why can't they be wrong about the other stuff they still promote as well? One of them is their conception of being pro-business and support for free markets, free trade, etc. And, you know, today that amounts to little more than a smokescreen for the support of essentially hyper-concentrated corporate power in the country, power which is tightly intertwined with the state and with the leftist power structure in America. I may actually do another podcast on this one, but I'm not going to dig too deep into that today. But that's essentially what a lot of it boils down to. And you'll note a lot of time conservatives, it's not just them, but they certainly do this, like to manipulate you with false dichotomies, right? They'll say, are you with us or are you with the terrorists? Look at how the Bush administration used that kind of propaganda to manipulate the country into the Iraq War. And they do the exact same thing on economics. Do you support capitalism or do you support socialism? You're not a socialist, are you? You're not a Marxist, are you? Don't you know how many people communism killed? Right, that'll fire up your boomercon base, to be sure. But as a friend of mine likes to say, there's a big difference between the capitalism of the lemonade stand and the capitalism of Goldman Sachs. Right, the question isn't whether you support capitalism or socialism. The question is, what kind of an economic system do we want to have in this country? And so I just want to drill in on one element of economic policy today, and that's free trade. Right, this sort of dogmatic belief that free trade is good that has really characterized movement conservatism. It's one of the things they still very much hold to, and it's one of the reasons that they were very opposed to Trump. I mean, again, if you look at the things that Trump really believed, I mean, quite apart from all his craziness, right, the things that he substantively argued for in his 2016 campaign that the Republican establishment didn't like, it was reducing immigration, rethinking free trade, and, you know, ending a lot of these foreign wars and interventions. And so trade is one that the establishment conservatives, they don't like it when you start criticizing free trade. And one of the things that happens when you start making arguments about free trade is you end up in arguments with economists. And it's really very hard to argue with an economist. It's sort of like trying to argue with a state DOT. You don't like this highway and the way that it's designed. You say, can you do this? Can you do that? And the people who are responding to you are technically trained civil engineers who can sort of use the, you know, public safety and many, many other things as sort of justifications for why, you know, their way should go. And if you don't have similar skills and qualifications, it can be very difficult to push back against that because who knows if it's true or not. And so you start arguing with an economist, and so they will pull out all this fancy math, right? And they'll pull out all these studies and all this literature that, you know, supposedly proves their point, right? Just look at all our economic data that demonstrates how horrible Trump's tariffs are for America, our economy, for example. Plenty of studies like that. And so, you know, I don't want to get down in the weeds of trying to argue with them on that. I just want to point out that you seldom see these free trade types and economists make big, substantive predictions about the future that actually pan out the way that they say they do, right? And so And to understand these folks, and in many cases, right, this is literally the same exact people we're talking about. The same people lecturing us today is the same people who were lecturing us 30 years ago. So let's go back in time. Let's go back in time to, say, 1994 and see what they're saying then and see how things turned out. And why did I pick 1994? You may notice, by the way, 1994 is my boundary line between the positive and the neutral world in my framework of positive, neutral, negative world Christianity. And this is one where, I may actually do a whole follow-up on that because people keep asking me, Aaron, why did you pick 1994? And the answer is there's nothing magic about 1994, okay? But there was a lot of interesting things going on in the country at that time. A lot of things were kind of perking in the air. One of the things that happened in 1994 is that's the year NAFTA took effect, the North American Free Trade Agreement. It was also the year that the Uruguay round of global trade talks were completed. And this is the round of trade talks that ended up creating the trade regime that we have today, created the WTO, et cetera. This is well before China would enter the WTO, which didn't happen until 2001. So this was really an era of free trade optimism. And the people who opposed free trade, people like Pat Buchanan, for example, I mean, they were vilified, still are, by the mainstream conservatives and even by the Democrats at the time, right? A lot of this happened in 1994. Bill Clinton was president. He supported this stuff. Or look at Ross Perot, right? He was running in 92. They rejected what he said. They rejected it. And so all the economists, all the smart people, they assured us free trade was awesome and it would be a huge benefit to America. And again, I'm not going to go back and try to look up all their precise arguments and calculate it. You can do the same if you want, but literally nothing's changed. It's the exact same arguments they still make about things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership and TPP or any opposing any type of tariff that Trump or anyone else might want to put in place, any kind of trade restriction, et cetera. They just think, you know, trade restrictions bad, you know, more free trade good. But, you know, there was actually a minority reports back then that turned out to be 1,000 times more accurate than what the economists told us. And one of them was a 1998 book, actually, by a guy named Richard Longworth. He was a former foreign correspondent for the Chicago Tribune, who later became a senior fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. In 1998, he put out a book called Global Squeeze, The Coming Crisis for First World Nations. This book is out of print, but you can still get it online on Amazon used. I suggest you do. I mean, it is still a great read today. It misses some things, okay, but man, it got a lot dead on. And by the way, Longworth was not the only person who called this. I'm just highlighting him because there's so many great quotes from his book. And so here's one of them. Here's what he had to say, quote, "World trade is based on the idea that each nation should make what it makes best and most cheaply, and then trade those wares to another nation for what that nation makes best and most cheaply. In the process, both nations will prosper and will have access to better goods than if they tried to do it all themselves. This is the principle of comparative advantage. It also has very little to do with trade in the real world of the global economy. Trade as it exists today bears little resemblance to the textbook images dear to the heart of free traders." And he goes on to say this about economist Robert Z. Lawrence, who, by the way, is still around. Today, he's the Albert L. Williams Professor of International Trade and Investment at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. He was on Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors. He was at Brookings, right? This is an inner party guy we're talking about here. Quoting Longworth, quote, "Lawrence and most of his mainstream colleagues are devoted free traders, literally trained from their undergraduate days to reject the thought that trade can cause more harm than good. Lawrence has even warned against letting such ideas get around, saying, quote, the very perception that a link exists between trade and labor problems could put the continuing evolution of trade and investment flows at risk, unquote. No one actually accuses these economists of faking their evidence to protect the sanctity of free trade, but it's clear that many economists have carefully limited their research to produce the results they wanted, unquote, Longworth. He goes on to warn about China and what's going to happen there. Again, this is 3 years before China would enter the WTO. Quote, China has every intention of upgrading its exports from clothing and toys to high-end, high-tech, high-profit goods such as cars, electronics, and pharmaceuticals, and it is using its trade and investment policies to force Western companies to help it achieve this mastery, which it clearly intends to employ to compete with these countries in the future. Western and Japanese companies that want to invest in China are forced to bring in modern technology and teach the Chinese how to do it. If Japan was a problem, China will be a catastrophe. It seems impossible that the world trade system, with all its benefits, can withstand an assault of this sort. The major nations must now begin planning new rules to limit aggressive exports of this sort and to demand strict reciprocity, equal access to the markets of China. This is, of course, both protectionism and managed trade, and will be attacked as such by purists who consider anything less than free trade a sin. But trade is an economic issue, not a theological one. The first world nations have civilizations worth protecting. If the price of that protection is some protectionism aimed at global predators, it seems folly not to pay it. Unquote. Again, this was written in 1998. Back then, people were celebrating the dot-com boom. I think the same year or thereabouts, there was a book that came out, the Dow 36,000 or something, that was just, you know, the stock market's going to quadruple, you know, 5-6 times up. China wasn't even in the World Trade Organization yet. They didn't have most favored nation status for trading in the U.S. But it was obvious to people who honestly looked at it what was coming. You know, and there's a million good quotes in this book, but I'll just end with this one, this last one here, quoting Longworth again, quote, "The logic of global markets leads to more pressures on workers, not less. Millions of new workers appear on the world market every year, all hungry and ready to compete. The power of computer-driven automation makes it at least possible that, for the first time, new technology will be a job destroyer, not job creator. This is the race to the bottom, a process that drives incomes ever lower. It is also straightforward supply and demand economics at work. This is the dehumanization of labor. No other major country treats its workers as commodities in this way, as raw materials or components that can be bargained to the lowest price." Unquote. Now keep in mind, until very recently, economists denied that trade with China had had much of any negative effect on employment in the U.S. It was not until a 2016 study called the China Shock, and I'll put a link to it in the show note, that the economics profession finally started admitting, and some still don't admit it, but basically I think they now mostly do, that trade with China had caused massive numbers of job losses. The China Stock study, the authors there found that 40% of manufacturing job losses between 2000 and 2007, about a million total job losses, were caused by the China Shock. Vox, the website, interviewed David O'Toole, one of the authors. Again, I'll throw a link to this in the show notes. And this is what they wrote. O'Toole and his collaborators' works have been hailed as some of the most important work on trade in decades. In modern economics, open trade has generally been regarded as a win-win for the countries involved, and the cost in terms of job displacements have been assumed to be modest and short-lived. O'Toole's findings, which surprised even him, have shown that's not always the case. Unquote. This is 18 years after Longworth's book, right, in which he, a non-economist, pointed out that these economists were full of it. I mean, it took the economics profession 18 years to catch up. And yet you still hear these guys lecturing us about the virtues of free trade and the horrors of protectionism in a very, very simplistic way, right? I mean, these economists' theories on trade were tried at scale in the U.S., and they failed, right? I mean, they failed in the sense that the theories did not correctly predict the scale and persistence of the dislocations that resulted, right? I mean, this is a WMD in Iraq scale failure to fail to predict the kind of job losses that were going to be caused by this trade. And, you know, as with Iraq, right, the people who brought it about, they're all still in high-level prestigious positions. It's the critics, right, who are mostly marginalized from back then, the Pat Buchanan and the paleocons, right, the same people who are trying to vote for Trump because their town's been devastated by all this stuff. And so that's just, free trade is just, it's just one aspect, right, of economic policy that needs to be thought, right? And again, you know, I just say, when these people show that their theories can predict the future in any material way, right, you know, and stuff that's important to actual human lived life, call me up. And I think until then, we are well within our rights to disregard what the economics profession tells us about trade. You know, maybe if they boot some of these guys who made all these predictions back in the 90s to the curb, we can say, hey, they cleaned house and now they're ready to try to start talking trade again. But until then, I think we can rightly just disregard it. Might we just disregard it? And again, free trade, and I'm not talking about like going to some mercantilist system here. I'm talking about this very dogmatic, hyper-simplistic, lecture me about Ricardo kind of free trade, right? It's just one of the many hyper-simplified, oversimplified, very theory-driven, reality-ignoring dogmas of conservatism on economic policy that needs to be rethought. In fact, you know, I might do a couple more episodes on various aspects of economic policy. I mean, their entire model of the economy, as understood right by the conservative right, is off in some very important ways. There's very important aspects of this that they have not considered, although people were talking about it, you know, close to 100 years ago, even conservatives, they've just essentially forgotten about it. I might go into that in a couple weeks, perhaps, because I think it's very interesting and very important. One of the most fundamentally important things to understand about the nature of the economy helps explain a lot of the behaviors of corporations today. But in the meantime, read up on the China shock and, you know, look at the people who made negative predictions about trade back in the 1990s and start asking yourself, like, you know, why are we still saying the same things now that were so wrong back then? Until next week, thanks for listening.